This week, I was going to focus in several sessions on a general theme. And the general theme was, or is, the other America. And the notion of the other America is the notion that here in America, we're accustomed to think or to believe that there is a particular culture and a particular language and a particular history and a particular style of life. And what I'm trying to convey is that there is more diversity than we even think there is. One of the things that I started doing this past Monday was to talk about those who live in the margin, or the history of at least the Hispanic community in the United States, and how that is an important part of what is known as America, but with a particular and focused experience. Today, I found very useful to do a session with Colleen Nelson, which is my wife, and talk about another aspect of this other America, and for us to be able to address what I think we both consider is a very important issue in this America that we live in, which is the challenge or the problems and the difficulties, but at the same time the promise, the possibility of enrichment of a multicultural family. On the one hand, to deal with how putting together a multicultural family can bring some real interesting issues and concerns and situations that are usually might become difficult to address, but on the other hand, how that particular experience might be tremendously enriching and enhancing to all the people involved, and by become an opportunity to learn some things. Not only for the people that are involved in that relationship, but with others as they relate with other people. I was going to start saying that there are some stereotypes, or there are some images that people have when they begin to speak about multicultural relationships or families or marriages. And in the Hispanic tradition or the perspective, there are some stereotypes on how people will usually end up reacting and how their lifestyle will eventually develop and be conditioned. One of the ways of thinking about how this happens is that when a Hispanic male tends to marry a non-Hispanic female and begin to build up a family, some of the things that will happen there is that the male will have a stronger influence on the kind of lifestyle, on the kind of experience and values that particular family is going to develop further on. Usually what will happen is that the spouse will learn Spanish very quickly, and the stereotype is that she will leave her own identity from which she was brought up, or that identity and that particular experience will not bear strongly on the particular character of that family, but the stronger position and the stronger perspective and the stronger way of relating and acting and developing will be from the Hispanic side. The other stereotype is that when a woman that is Hispanic usually marries a non-Hispanic, what will happen again is that that Hispanic woman will lose her, to a great extent, her way of life, so to speak, her upbringing, her values, her culture, and will assimilate to the culture of the dominant male. And that has happened. Interestingly enough, one of the things that happens usually is that in the first case, when the male is Hispanic, there is a sense of struggling with the notion of extended family. So the woman becomes involved in all the networks of what could be called the notion of extended family in Hispanic, the Hispanic tradition. And when the opposite happens, the Hispanic woman tends to lose the connections with all the ties from her Hispanic, as you say, family and extended family. And when I talk about extended family, I mean that in many Hispanic families, you don't deal just with the nuclear family, the father, the son, and the father, the spouse, the mother, then the son and the daughter and the children, but the family is the grandparents, the aunts, the uncles. Everybody begins, plays a very significant role. And what happens is that that either begins to shape up or become stronger, or it tends to diminish to a certain degree. But again, we're talking about experiences that tend to be stereotyped.
And I guess as part of my story, I want to give an example of that. But before I do, since we have a small group, I guess I'd like to have a kind of a give and take and a discussion, and not just a presentation. We have stories, experiences to share with you. But if you have questions, I hope we can just have a kind of a give and take. And not have a real formal thing going on here.
Well, you give
it. Okay. Oh, well, I don't think so. I guess I want to say that this stereotype is operative not only in the Hispanic community, but in our world as well. And I want to give you my example to point that out and to let you know why we feel that this is such an important topic. Because I think our aim is to not let the stereotype take over, that you go in either one direction or the other, but that you try to do both. But Jose and I'll just say brief, we're going to get into our history a little more, but we met at seminary. We were both students there, and before we got married, I had been there for 3 years, so I had 2 years of seminary and internship, and I felt that I had established myself as an individual. I came as a single parent, I had 2 kids, and I worked really hard, and I did participate in all the activities, and I felt that I was really had established my identity, and also was establishing my pastoral identity so that I would be a pastor, and people would see me for who I was. And Jose and I had sort of really gotten together over internship, so that a lot of people didn't know we were together, so it came as a surprise when we got married at the end of internship and we came back to the seminary community. Mm-hmm. But what I found, to my surprise and I guess horror, was that immediately even my favorite professors and the people who knew me well started asking me if I was now going to be in Hispanic ministry. And everybody knew that I did not speak Spanish. But the assumption was that I would be in Hispanic ministry. And I found myself now connected with all kinds of groups. I was now part of the foreign students. I was a part of the wives of foreign students. I was automatically assumed that I was part of all these groups. So that I was part of the dominant culture. But as soon as I married a Hispanic, then it was assumed that I was now Hispanic. So these stereotypes are operative on both sides, the Anglo side and the Hispanic side. And that was extremely difficult for me because part of going to seminary was my establishing my identity and figuring out what I needed to do with my life and where I would go. So it caused some problems in that I took Spanish courses, I took classes, and I still don't, I can understand a few things, but I don't speak Spanish. And I feel like it was a mental block saying, no, I'm not going to fit into that stereotype. So everywhere I go, people ask me if I speak Spanish. And that leads to another example. The interview process, when I was out interviewing, I ran into all the stereotypes and the questions that people had about our family and what it was like, how it was different than other families. Because I was interviewing at churches that were, you know, just your basic Anglo churches in Chicago, in the city of Chicago. And one of them, I'll never forget this discussion. And women get asked strange questions at interviews anyway, just so you know. Just so you know. I mean, all kinds of family questions a man would never be asked. But so we get asked all these questions. And so we had this discussion, and everybody always says, well, if your husband is Hispanic, do you speak Spanish? And then I always have to say, no, I'm working on it, I'm taking a class, but I don't speak Spanish yet. So we had this little discussion, and a little further into the interview process, someone said, well, first they asked me all kinds of questions about what he was doing and what he, you know, what kind of job he had and how, whether he was going to stay in town. And then they said, is he bilingual? And I said, she's got it all in. I said, oh, yes, he is completely bilingual. As a matter of fact, the seminary has hired him to teach in Spanish so that they could have a Spanish program there, and he takes care of Hispanic ministry. So he's completely bilingual. And the guy said, no, I meant, does he speak English? And I went, we never take each other home. This happened to me, honestly, it happened to me. So language, I mean, it's this confusing thing for people. What happens when you have this multiculturality, two languages going on? They didn't understand. I didn't say that. We never speak to each other. We only point. But the stereotypes are operative. There's no question about it. So that's what we're going to try to deal with today is sort of alternative ways of working it out. The multicultural family.
Yeah, before moving along, maybe what I'd like to really stress is that speaking in two languages is a very symbolic way of how you address differently certain issues, how you look at reality sometimes differently, how connections are made in a different fashion, how a set of principles and values are developed. And one of the problems that I think we struggle with is that when you stereotype things, or when you want the other, a person always to assimilate to your values, what you're doing is a tremendous violence to somebody else who has been brought up in a different sort of environment, with a different set of values, with different lifestyles, and you're sort of telling that person that what that person learned, or how that person functioned both rationally and intuitively, and the set of signals that signal something to be right or wrong, are totally either irrelevant or not good. So what you're telling the person in these stereotypes modes of relationship is that you have to deny yourself. You have to deny what is much more meaningful to you in order to enter into a relationship. And what we think is that we need to develop some alternative modes of and ways of operation so that you don't do violence to another person, but you begin to find out what are the ways that a relationship can be mutually enriching. So that's a sort of a principle that we're trying to convey here, that we have to be very careful many, many times when we assume that the other person needs to assimilate to our set of values, because what we're saying is that there are some good values and there are some bad values, and there are some things that are valuable to keep and there are some others that are very negative, and there is a sense of violence when you're telling someone that you have to get rid of some of the most important things that have given you a way of coping with life, a way of relating to others. So that's an overall important element that we want
to. And let me just say that maybe I have to be the most careful about that because we are living in my culture, and so it would tend to dominate if we're not really careful. And I always need for Jose to remind me if I'm really stepping on his value system or his way of being, that's different from those of us here who grew up in what's going on here.
And finally,
how is that different than my experience of marrying a guy who is from an immigrant family from Russia? So grew up in a family where the English that was spoken was a sort of a crazy variety that was learned, I don't know, from several different sources. And they had all these cultural traditions, and plus it was in Brooklyn, which is certainly different than growing up in suburban Seattle, which is where I grew up. And trying to learn that culture and trying to honor that culture in our relationship, how is that different from your experience?
Okay.
What's the distinction?
Well, let me react first then.
Okay, quick, very, very quickly. Every relationship has those adjustments.
Yeah.
And there's no question about it. And Jose and I are always reflecting on the fact that we were both married before. And I married someone, you know, who was from the same town where I went to high school. And I have more in common with Jose intrinsically than I had with that other person. Mm-hmm. So you have all these various factors that are going on. Jose married someone who was from a town right next to his. You know, was she born in your town?
We were
your
born
town?
In the same town, in the same hospital.
In Puerto Rico.
In Puerto Rico. I mean, we
and
were both from...
More or less, because... but she grew up... Go ahead.
We were both a preacher's kid. Her father was a pastor. My father was a pastor. Mm. We both had some sort of exposure to the inner city experience. We both had some experience in the United States, but she had more. Because what happened was that early on, when she was 3 years old, her mother competed for a scholarship and was given a scholarship for a program of studies at Columbia University. And from there on, they stayed in the United States. And her father used to work as a public teacher in Brooklyn, New York. But they live in New Jersey, in Jersey City. I guess that one of the important, or what I would consider significant difference, might have been the fact that I am a Puerto Rican. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
One of the biggest troubles that my former wife had in trying to establish her identity when she was growing up in New Jersey and in Jersey City and Brooklyn was that you always notice a slight accent. And she was confronted with the fact that that identified her. Well, I think that what I wanted finally to
Which
respond
she's
to...
She's not here.
But we gotta move
okay,
on.
Okay, all right.
Was that the difference I would say might be important is that for my former wife to be able to feel good about her identity, living in Brooklyn at that time, and knowing everybody and herself too that she had a Spanish accent, was to tell others, her peers and you know others who asked that question, that she came from Spain and not from Puerto Rico. Because in that particular context, in Brooklyn, the Bronx and New York, to be a Puerto Rican meant to be a speck, to be the worst of human beings, because who are the Puerto Ricans? Those who write graffiti, those who are related to the famous play West Side Story, who a Puerto Rican is a person who carries a knife in his or her hand. And to be a Puerto Rican, for a lot of Puerto Ricans, to be able to survive emotionally meant that they either had to be engaged in violence for them to feel that, you know, no one was going to kick them around, or to deny what they were. And in a particular culture where even in the storybook, the history books, you don't find your history there, or you find very little related to Hispanic tradition, which is very in a country like this, is very surprisingly, because if you go to the Southwest, I mean, San Agustin is a city and was established by the Spanish colonizers even beyond, before, much before than Virginia, or you know, the Pilgrims coming. And when you go to San Jose or you go to California...
But they lost the war.
Well, see, that's probably what the problem is, that there is a sense that is negative or is bad because they lost.
But the only history that counts as real history is Northern European history.
It's a North-South right? thing too, isn't it? Like,
I think we are beginning to break down those stereotypes. But it's the sense that everything that relates to you or to your identity, you have to deny it. And what that brings, again, is a sense, you're doing violence to a lot of people, and you're saying that there's just one, among the world cultures, there are some that are good and there are some that are bad. You know, that's really problematic, because I don't think that we can reach those kind of conclusions unless we do have either historical amnesia or selective memory.
But we have both.
We really do have both.
Yeah. I mean, we're in Colorado right now, and it's real clear that the only history that counts is European history, Northern European history. And the whole Spanish-Mexican development of that country, I mean, when we voted for English as an official language. And, you know, then they had cartoons about the fact that you'd have to lose the name Colorado. You know, everything, right down, and...
Yeah, and what I think people don't realize is that when one tends to focus on just one particular view or one language or one way of doing things, what we are really doing to ourselves is limiting ourselves and narrowing ourselves in terms of what we can become as human beings. And that's the whole problem of the stereotype way of relating in families, that the either or mentality is very negative in the long run for people themselves. And what I think we have learned and we're trying to do is to open up the doors for a different way of relating and a different way of appreciating the gifts that different people and different cultures and different experiences bring to each other. For example, one of the things that I intentionally do at the seminar, at the time of orientation, when all the new students come, is that I say my name. My name is José David Rodríguez Hernández. I teach systematic theology at the seminary. I also am the director of Hispanic ministry, but during Christmas and sometimes during the summers, I go to visit my Swedish relatives in Iowa. And for me, that's important. See, the idea is not to say that since I'm Hispanic, only my Hispanic heritage is the only good one, but how, in my experience, which I take very seriously, I mean, I know that there is a lot of violence in the history of how Puerto Rico became a territory of the United States, and I don't want to deny that. Why should I deny that? To make the same mistakes with other groups? Maybe when the Hispanic population in the United States becomes to increase in numbers, then we can say, well, since the African American did this to us, we're going to do it to the African American. I mean, that's nonsense. The idea is to go critically to your background and not have a naive understanding of your history, but a more critical and more realistic, because it is in coming to terms with the good things and the bad things that happen in your history that you begin to develop alternative ways of relating and looking at it, so you can learn the best and not try to make the same mistakes. So but it's difficult. I mean, it's very difficult to do, because we're talking about things, issues, and principles that give our identity, that talk about the innermost valuable things that we're not willing to give up very quickly. So it's an ongoing learning experience that there's no way of shortcutting it. You need to come to terms with it, with the good things and the bad things, and the ambiguities of it. And of course, people of faith know that we have a lot of good examples in the history of the scriptures that tells us that God is among those who have to struggle and those who are in the margins. And there is a promise of not being self-centered. See, the problem, I think, and I'm going to stop there.
I don't know what we want to cover, because I want to say something about Nancy's question too.
Yeah. Well, let me finish it. The problem with dealing with either or relationships is that you tend to establish yourself over against the other one and do violence to the other one. What we learn as Christians is that that's the sin of self-centeredness. And ultimately, if we go to the scriptures, cultures and diversity are gifts of God for our mutual enhancement, and not weapons to use against other people. So I think that's a very important learning element within the context of the Christian tradition that helped, at least us, address this matter of bringing multicultural family together. That was it.
I wanted to reflect on Nancy's question of Ron's background, and one thing we've noticed ourselves is that my ancestry is Swedish, and almost all of them came from Sweden, but it was several generations back. And when they came, they had money to come one way. They came to be Americans, we like to say North Americans now, but they came to be a part of this culture. They came to fit in. They came to take advantage of what was here and to start a new life. And what we have going on in our day now, I think, is a little different, and probably even just a couple generations makes a difference. That his ancestors came here to make it here. And Jose is staying here because he's married, basically. He's a Puerto Rican. But there's a sense in the immigrants that are coming now that they have the mobility to go back and forth to keep their roots, certain ones of them. Now, you can't generalize for each culture. Some of the people are coming, and they know, like the people from Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia, they have to try to fit in and make it in this culture, because they don't have any opportunity to go back.
They also hold on to their culture, though. I teach Vietnamese and Hmong children in Minneapolis, along with others.
And they hold on. But yeah. We have the opportunity to do that now. The melting pot theory has sort of gone out the window. And the idea is multiculturality and cooperation between cultures, and not everybody fitting into one. And I find that very, very difficult for people who have been here, who they don't know what to do with it. And I was going to give this example later, but I won't have time later, so I'm going to tell you now. I'm a pastor of a congregation on the north side of Chicago, and we're not in a Hispanic neighborhood or a black neighborhood, but we have a lot of new immigrants coming in. And they're coming from various places. They're coming from Asia, from a lot of us are coming from Russia, Poland, various places. And the first month I was there, I was in charge of the adult forum Bible study on Sunday morning. So I said, okay, I'm going to start this out. We're going to talk about the Bible first. So I brought my Hebrew Old Testament, I brought my Greek New Testament. I said, we're going to look at the language, and I know you don't know the language, but we're going to talk about language issues and the difficulty of translation and how important this is. And we talked about that for 5 minutes. And everybody says, language. Why do these people think they have to keep their language? Why do we have all these people on the street that refuse to learn English? Why can't they fit in? Why can't they be like all the rest of us? We had to do it when we came. Our ancestors had to do it when they came. Why can't they do it? So language, it's becoming a really significant issue for people. And those who were part of the melting pot of their ancestry was don't understand the importance now of the difference between inclusivity and diversity. They want to be inclusive in my congregation, which means everybody come and be a part of us. Okay, it sounds great on the surface, but what we're asking them to do is to be like us. And if we really open our doors and ask people to come in, it means that we have to change and they have to change. You know, that we have to do some kind of cooperating. And it's a whole different concept of what we're working with. And I guess that what we're saying is that our situation might be a microcosm of what's happening in society. And we're looking for new visions and new ways of being that honors both and doesn't ask to be the same.
You're not saying that it's acceptable for people to come here and not learn English, are you?
It's an impatience with their ability to do it more, I think.
Because they are.
And it's an impatience with them wanting to keep their culture.
But
too.
Economically, they won't assimilate until they do learn the language, and that's a real...
The Russians are, I mean, they are very, I mean, we, that's who's come, the Russian Jews are coming into my particular neighborhood. In large numbers, we go to the park and everybody speaks Russian, but us, I mean, it's that. They're going to English classes like crazy.
Right.
They're filling the community college and working hard. And working hard. But I think the idea in this day is to keep both.
Okay.
You know, we all gave up, my ancestors all gave up their Swedish. Yeah. Nobody knows Swedish, you know.
But what I think is more important, though, is that learning English shouldn't mean thinking that the way to succeed in life is a practical way of being successful according to the standards of the dominant culture, because sometimes the standard of the dominant culture is developed at the cost of the humanity of that culture and the humanity of other cultures. So you have to break a pattern of narrowing down what you need to survive in life. And to think that you have to learn English and get rid of all the other things that might come into play in your learning English might be developing a very practical-minded attitude toward life, that there's only one way you need and you're going to get that way at the cost of everything else. And learning other languages don't only bring you an understanding of how people speak, but how they think, how they relate. And for example, I think that one of the most interesting, you're talking to a person that had to learn 7 languages. I get the feeling that the more you learn, the better prepared you are in life. But what I've learned too is that usually the problem of learning something comes out of the practical necessity of getting something. And there is a very dangerous experience of trying to learn something just for the sake of what you can get out of it. I mean, get the practical notion of you can use that for something. I think that the learning process is broader than that. The learning process is to have resources accessible to you for the purpose of humanizing yourself, and not for the purpose of dehumanizing yourself or dehumanizing other people. And that's why narrowing your understanding of how you have access to things might be either an empowering experience or a very limiting experience. So what I think is that we need to really ask the question of how languages help humanize, or how resources help develop your humanity to the utmost. In fact, in theological education, all the things that we're learning very clearly, and especially these last days, is that theological education cannot be done in isolation of other groups. The main theme of theological education today is the globalization of theology. And what that means is that if your context is very important. But your context is also related to other contexts and other ways of experiencing the word of God and the gift of God. And if you, if people are not able to make those connections, what happens is that there is a tendency for practical purposes to do violence to others. And then the word of God is reinterpreted in a way that only serves your own purposes, your self-centered purposes. And I think the same thing happens in society. When you, I think that the what I'm being very, very much impressed is that in those societies where there's more than one language spoken, by the necessity, let's say, for example, Switzerland, or you know those border regions, what you gain is a more broader understanding of how people relate, and you understand what are the kinds of relationships that are enhancing, but the kind of relationships that are mutually negative. And I guess that the issue of language needs to be placed also in that kind of context. Language can serve a lot of purposes, but if you're not aware that one of the purposes that it can serve is towards the dehumanization of the one who speaks and the one who uses it, then it can become a very difficult problem. But should we tell other stories?
Well, I think we have 10 minutes, right?
Yeah.
What would you all like to know? should we open it up, or do you want to say something?
Yeah, I wanted to say that we are working sort of with a principle of operation, which I think we're learning the dimensions of that principle more and more. This is not something that we're going to say, if you do this, you have it all made, but it's something that has worked for us, and I think we think and we believe that it's valuable. And is that to deal with integrity and to relate to each other, we need to have a sense of mutuality. But that sense of mutuality is built upon certain elements too. First of all, a sense of trust, a sense of patience. Gosh, I hope that Colleen will always be patient with me, because unfortunately I'm not always as patient as I should be with her. But patience is a very important key here. Another important principle, I think, is the willingness to try new things. See, I've learned a great deal of how to handle children or how to deal with certain issues of my life that I tended to be very narrowly minded, predisposed to. And another point...
But even culturally, I think, dealing with each other's culture, you have to be willing to try.
Right.
Jose was, when I met him, he was mostly relating to Hispanics. You see, in Chicago, you can do that.
Yeah,
relating
right,
to Hispanics. And I didn't know how at all. It was very intimidating for me the first time I went to a Hispanic gathering, because it was reversed. I was the only one who wasn't, and just to be willing to try, to to do different things.
And an important also principle is to decide things not by an either or, but by common agreement on the kind of a decision that you're going to arrive at. So for us, it's very important to say, well, you do these things this way and I do these things that way. But it's not a matter of doing it just your way or my way, but see how the different ways can be mutually enhancing. And that's the end.
That's what you want.